Welcome to this bonus episode of The Art of the Exit. I'm Alex Sugg. In our last episode, we went inside the story of D.B. Cooper and his miraculous crime. If you haven't heard yet, I'd encourage you to go back and listen to that episode to get the full context of this story. This bonus episode is an uncut interview with Tom Kay. He was the paleontologist who was hired by the FBI to study the evidence that was found and connected to Cooper. In this interview, you'll hear about new pieces that were not mentioned in our episode. There are a lot of discoveries he made, including a very important trace of evidence that Cooper accidentally, or not so accidentally, left behind before his escape.
So the D.B. Cooper case is an interesting sideline because of all of the kind of mysteries. This one has some rare characteristics. Number one, it actually happened, you know, versus things like Oak Island, which actually never happened. So the fact that this happened and that it's the only unsolved skyjacking in U.S. history makes it unique. Also, the fact it was long enough ago that they couldn't apply modern forensic techniques to the case, but you know, not so long ago that evidence still isn't, you know, is gone and evidence is still available. So there's a couple of interesting characteristics. If you look around and say, well, are there any other things like that, it's actually hard to find another mystery to investigate that has those same characteristics.
Gotcha. Okay. So when you were working on it, what exactly were you doing?
Well, originally I was contacted because the FBI had never analyzed the money that was buried on Tina Bar. So it was buried on Tina Bar for like 9 years, potentially. So as a paleontologist, I study things that have been buried in the ground for a long time.
Right.
So although the connection doesn't make sense at first, when you explain it that way, it makes a little more sense. So the FBI couriered the Cooper money down to my lab here in Arizona, and we examined it. And we did a pretty good job on that. The FBI realized we were fairly serious. And then from there, that opened the door to seeing all of the evidence with the D.B. Cooper case, which was fairly unusual. You know, they don't usually invite outside people in to do examinations on cases. But this case was very old and very cold. Larry Carr, who was the special agent in charge of the case at that time, wanted very much to work on it, but his boss wouldn't let him. His boss said, you know, you're not spending time and money on a, you know, old case like this. So Larry Carr convinced his boss to let him release the information to the public and let the public work on it. And that was really the turning point, you know, about 10 years ago. So once the information was released, as the internet is known to do, Cooper people came together and started examining it. And that's been going on ever since. So the evidence and the new information in the case, such as the fact he left his tie on the plane, all kind of came to light about 10 years ago. And since then, a lot of work has been done on it. And that's kind of how I've been following along that group.
Gotcha. So I have a few questions regarding the evidence that you were able to look at. But I think first is how much money was discovered, and when you were examining the money, what did you find? Like, what were some of the interesting findings you had with it?
Well, there were three bundles of cash. There were $20 bills. They knew it was Cooper's money because the serial numbers lined up. So it's about $6,000. They couldn't identify every bill. So the assumption is the original bills were 100 to a pack, and there were three packs. So the assumption is $6,000. What we did was we looked at the bills under the electron microscope to look very carefully at what was had accumulated on the bills at the microscopic level. So one of the things we were looking for instance, is these things called diatoms, which are small, hard-shelled creatures that live in the water. And if you had those on there, then you could kind of tell where they're kind of unique to various areas. So the ones in saltwater are different from the ones in freshwater, et cetera. So we looked for those. We looked for any other particles on the tie that would be unusual, not sand. One of the unusual things we did find on the tie was silver. Some of the bills were black. So that led us on an investigation as to how did these bills turn black from silver. Well, after quite a bit of research into this, we found out that the FBI had put silver nitrate looking for fingerprints on the bills, and that's what turned them black. Mm. Silver nitrate is the same thing they use on black and white photographs. So at that time, that was a standard procedure for fingerprints, but the one thing we learned about dealing with evidence from the FBI is that if there's a negative result, they don't record that fact in the history books that they've got for the case. They're called 302s. So we kind of went in circles on that for a little while, thinking it was something important. It turned out not to be. So the money at the end of the day looked like it was in the ground for a long time, and it had rotted there instead of being moved there via water transport mechanisms. It was originally thought that the money landed up by Ariel Washington 20 miles away, and the money bill somehow tumbled down rivers, ended up in the Columbia, and got washed up onto the shore of the Columbia through a dredging operation that was happening up and down the Columbia. Well, we did some experiments with money being buried in water and buried under sand, and there was rubber bands that were still intact on the bundles when they were found by Brian Ingram on the beach. And that was kind of the key to the mystery, because rubber bands don't last more than 6 months in the wild without falling apart. So there was no way you could have rubber bands holding those bundles together for years as they rolled down the streams. So the money, in our opinion, most likely got there very quickly after the event and stayed there the whole time and became uncovered as the sand was washed away.
Interesting. Okay, so when you say quickly after the event, what exactly are you implying? Like, it maybe he had buried the money quickly after the jump?
Well, you see, that's where the whole mystery comes in on the money. The money remains probably one of the bigger mysteries in the Cooper case, because we can't connect the dots between where he jumped in Ariel, Washington, 20 miles away, and how you end up on Tina Bar and there's money under the sand. We can find no natural explanation of how the money could get there. Hmm. So the kind of knee-jerk reaction to that is, well, then somebody put it there, probably Cooper. Well, we're not saying that. We don't know that. We have no evidence that any human or anything else put it there, but we have evidence to say that it didn't get there by natural means. So how it got there is still a big mystery, and there is no simplistic explanation for it. Some people try and adjust the flight path to say, oh, he jumped out over Tina Bar and the money fell out of his back and landed on Tina Bar, et cetera, et cetera. But there is no good explanation for it. Do I think Cooper was involved? It would make no sense for Cooper to end up on Tina Bar, which is kind of off in the corner and not on any kind of exit path from where he was up in Ariel, Washington. So how he got there, it remains a mystery, and there is no good evidence pointing in any one direction as to how it got there.
Mm. If you had to, and I might be putting you on the spot a little bit here, but if you had to guess, like your opinion, maybe what you might not be able to prove based on evidence, but if you had a knee-jerk reaction where you're leaning, and if you had to say what you'd guess, is your guess that Cooper brought it there and left it, or what would your guess be?
You know, if I was going to speculate, maybe Cooper bribed somebody to take him to the airport, and maybe that guy went fishing and then found out he aided and abetted a criminal. Maybe he buried the money trying to, you know, not be involved. I don't know. You know, it's some stupid story like that. That is obviously a wild speculation. But it'll be some crazy, crazy story about how somebody or something ended up with the money, and that somebody something ended up on Tina Bar, and the money got buried.
Mm. What are your thoughts on Cooper? At what level, like what percentage would you say is likely that he survived the jump out of the plane?
We'd say at this point in the game, very likely.
Okay.
Which is, it goes against what the FBI thought back in the day. So back in the day, jumping out of a plane at 200 miles an hour, it seemed like it would shred the parachute, or you would get disoriented. It was dark out. There was clouds. It was raining. So there was a lot of reasons back then to say that, you know, he didn't make it. Also, was a very convenient way to kind of shut down the case. Today, we know
right.
that when you jump out of an airplane at 200 miles an hour, the chute does not open right away. It does what we call squidding. So you would slow down there. You could make that jump. If you did land in the deep, dark death woods, is what they called it back then, that area is actually not as desolate as you might think up by Ariel, Washington. if you walked a mile or so through the woods, you'd run into a road almost in any direction. Hmm. So there's almost no reason that that he couldn't have survived that jump. Now, the reason why we think he survived is if he died, there would be evidence like a body or parachute or something. And maybe you wouldn't have found it in the first 6 months after the jump. But, you know, more than 40 years now on after the jump, like I say, that area's got people all through it. You wouldn't be able to hide a body in a parachute in that neighborhood that long without finding it.
Right.
So also the fact that the money left the area there, you know, one thing we do know is that the money left the aerial area. So that happened somehow. So he, you know, if he buried himself in the woods where nobody could find him, how did the money get away from the body and onto Tina Bar?
Right. So how much time did you spend studying this case?
Oh, weeks, weeks and weeks and weeks. Yeah, we ended up making two trips out to the Tina Bar aerial. This is Seattle. Made two trips to Seattle to go through the archive. We spent a lot of hours on the electron microscope examining hundreds and hundreds of particles on his tie. We did a lot of research as to what was going on with pollen. We found pollen on the tie. So, yeah, we spent a lot of time on it, actually, much more than we expected. And I had a team of two other people that were also working on it.
Gotcha. So, and with that time, maybe from, if you had to say, when you entered the case till the end, when you maybe wrapped up your work on it, what's the most surprising thing you would say you found in it that maybe you weren't anticipating? What's the thing that sticks out to you when you remember working on it today?
Well, the most important thing that we found that we were not expecting was the types of particles we found on the tie. So the scooper left his tie on the plane, and he probably did it by mistake because he was very careful to take back everything else that he touched, the matchbooks, the notes, everything that he had handled, he was careful to take with him off the plane. We think that he mistakenly left the tie on the plane. It was a dark tie on a dark seat, and he had turned off all the lights in the plane. So the tie is the only piece of evidence that points backwards in time to where Cooper came from. Mm. So a tie happens to be the one piece of clothing you never wash.
Right.
So in essence, it picks up particles from everywhere you are in your daily life for the entire time you've owned that tie. So of all the pieces he could have left on the plane, that was the best one.
Wow. And still, you couldn't track him down.
Well, what we did was when we first got involved in this case, after, you know, so many decades of the FBI looking into it, the odds of who Cooper was anybody in the country. He could have been any white male, you know, in his 40s in the country. Once we started looking at the tie particles, they were so unusual that we were able to narrow him down to a field of, you know, a couple thousand people at the most.
What made them unusual?
Well, there was titanium on the tie. Now, titanium is something that is very common today, but back in 1971, that was a very rare thing to find out in the public. They didn't make golf clubs and things out of titanium back in 71. It was pretty much only used in military aircraft and just beginning to be used in commercial aircraft and starting to be used in chemical processing plants.
So what if
so right
if
off the bat you knock them down into one of those three areas?
Gotcha. So I conducted one other interview for this, and the gentleman, I asked him if he felt like he has also spent a lot of time researching the subject, and he wrote a book on it and all kinds of stuff. And I asked him if he felt like there was pretty conclusive evidence that D.B. Cooper, Dan Cooper, had some sort of background in planes or parachuting or both. And if that were the case, if that would kind of knock down, you know, the list of people that it could have been, because it seemed like he had so much knowledge about the plane. He had so much knowledge about how to escape if he did survive, that a normal, you know, person wouldn't have access to that information. The person I asked, he said, sure, that's a good point. But how much of an education did he have on planes? Was he a pilot, or did he just know about planes? Was he a parachuter? You know, like what for you, how much did it narrow your search down when you saw the titanium on the tie?
Well, it's because of the rarity of the titanium. Mm-hmm. You know, you can only be, that tie was somewhere to get titanium on it. So that narrows it way down. Now, was he part of an airplane manufacturing process? That's debatable, because the titanium that goes into airplanes is always alloyed, or 99% of it is alloyed. So they don't use pure titanium on airplanes. They mix it with other things. And the titanium that we found on the tie was pure. So that points away from being involved with something like Boeing. The supersonic transport project was going on at that time. And actually, the airplane was canceled in 1971. So it would be a very easy thing to say, oh, he worked on the SST project, he worked for Boeing, he got stuff on his tie, and he got laid off, and now he was upset and went and hijacked the plane. But really, the evidence doesn't point in that direction, because he would not have pure titanium on his tie. He would have some form of alloyed titanium. So we don't think he worked for Boeing. We don't think he was involved in the airplane industry. Whether or not he was involved in something else is what we're researching. So his knowledge of airplanes was... it goes both ways. He specifies, you know, flying under 10,000 feet in the flaps of 15 degrees, but he never specified where to fly. So they were debating about whether they should fly him out over the ocean, let him jump into the ocean. So, I mean, on the one hand, he was very smart. On the other side, he was very stupid. As far as his parachuting experience, he threw away the instructions on how to put on the parachute, but then he took the reserve chute that was marked for training use only with him out the plane, when he jumped out of the plane. And he took the good chute and he cut it up and left it on the plane, the good reserve parachute. Also, as a skydiver, you call them main and reserve, and he asked for front and back parachutes. So that's not something an experienced skydiver would say. An experienced skydiver would also never jump out of a plane in regular street chutes, which is what he had on. So there are things that point both ways, and that's one of the mysteries of the investigation, is how do you push the pros and cons into a coherent explanation for who Cooper was and why he did it.
Gotcha. I have one final question to kind of wrap things up, and I'm interested because you've spent so much time and you've researched so much and you've kind of had to really dive not only into the story, but also somewhat into like the mind of this person and why they would do what they do and where they would end up. And I'm curious, do you think Dan Cooper was he some sort of like, I feel like there's this mythology, if you look online, about D.B. Cooper, where it's almost like a anti-hero story to a lot of people, but there's this other side to it to me that feels almost undeniable, that he was mentally unwell, or there's something there. I don't know if he was this like genius escape artist so much as someone who was extremely lucky, and I would love to hear your opinion on that, which way you would tend to lean. Was he
this? Well, I think he's more lucky than genius.
Yeah,
he was not the first guy to jump out of an airplane like that. He wasn't the last. Hmm. He gets all the credit, but he by no means thought it all up on his own. He may have, but there was other people that had done it before him. They just all got caught or died in the process. So I think he was luckier than smart. He took some precautions, didn't take others. He was a gentleman, though. I mean, he had food brought in for the pilots, knowing it was going to be a long trip. You know, he tried to tip the flight attendants, and they turned it down. They turned down the money. You know, when he got the money, he was so happy, he tried to give them some, and they said, no, we can't take tips, which they were chided on afterwards, saying you should have gotten some of the money back. So, you know, he did not act like a hardened, typical criminal, didn't care about anybody. He really seemed that this was like something he was kind of forced into doing. It was a do or die scenario. So I would say he was more likely a fairly typical guy that got forced into a non-typical situation, is the way I think of him. A lot of people have a different opinions about him. There's anything that points to him being a hardened criminal doing this just for the cash.
Yes. When you say forced into it, what do you mean by that? Like his life forced him into it, like maybe financial.
Well, like a Breaking Bad kind of thing,
yeah.
You know, where circumstances, you find yourself in circumstances where your only out is to do something crazy and illegal. So I think that would be my take on him. Because he certainly, you know, he thought about a lot of other people in doing the case. And he did a lot of stupid things. He went into the bathroom and spent time in the bathroom, and everybody was thinking maybe we should just run out the door while he was in the bathroom. I mean, that's just dumb.
Yeah.
You know, you're not a hardened criminal and do that. So he did have the bomb in the case, but we're pretty sure it's fake at this point because it had red sticks in there, and red sticks are not usually dynamite, things like that.
Gotcha.
So nothing he did was polished, and nothing he did was, you know, he was thinking about a lot of people in the process. It's probably the best way to put it.
Gotcha. I lied. This is really my last question. And you know, I have to ask you, who do you think is Dan Cooper?
So, you know, we don't have any suspects. We don't, you know, everybody else promotes a suspect. If you talk to the people in the Cooper world, everybody's got their favorite suspect.
Yeah,
we don't have a suspect. Yeah. We have a profile. Right.
I've seen a lot of people who their uncle or their grandpa or all these, you know, I've seen a lot of that.
Every
online.
Year there's a new suspect, right?
Yeah.
Every single year somebody jumps up and says, well, my father, my brother, my mother, my neighbor. Right.
Yeah.
And there is one case where they think he was female and was dressing up as a man. So the Cooper suspects go the full range. So what we have is we have a profile based on the evidence we've looked at.
Okay, and what does that look like?
We think he's an engineer or management in industry where they're manufacturing parts out of pure titanium. There was also some recent research we had done in conjunction with McCrone Laboratories where they found rare earth elements on the tie and some other fairly specialized particles. And that points away from titanium manufacturing towards something like cathode ray tube manufacturing, where they have phosphors and things like that. So these rare earth elements that were found on his tie were pretty much only used in manufacturing TV tubes at the time. But there was also a lot of stainless steel on the tie, which would not be found in a regular TV manufacturing facility. So we think now that he was in some kind of a high-end custom cathode ray tube manufacturing process that got these rest of these types of particles on his tie. So we're investigating Tektronix outside of Portland because they were manufactured their own tubes for their oscilloscopes in the 70s. And that's what we're looking into currently.
Do you have any profile that you'd guess on his, maybe more of his personal life? You think he's a family man? You think he's a loner? What would you guess?
No evidence to point either way. You know, we only have a very small snapshot of him while he was on the plane. And then it's all secondhand information based on what people said about interacting with him after the fact. So, no, I got no opinion on which way he was there. Probably more of a normal guy. Probably wouldn't, if you met him, I don't think he would stand out to you as unusual. Let's put it that way.
Gotcha. Tom Kay, thank you so much for your time.
Sure, no problem. Glad to do it.
Thank you for listening to The Art of the Exit from Yahoo Finance. Please leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you enjoyed this bonus episode.